Hi, this is Superman, and you need more front wing.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Wallcraft, joined by my co-editor Paul Dalby, and also joined this evening for a little while anyway, very pleased to have back on the show John Oriovitz, who is, of course, the IndyCar expert who writes for ESPN.com as well as some other websites across the web. John, thank you so much for your time today. Very, very glad to have your insight as always.
Well, it's a pleasant evening in Speedway, Indiana. Thanks for having me on.
So we're definitely going to spend some time tonight tapping John's experiences at the inaugural IndyCar Series doubleheader in Detroit, because of the three of us, he was the only one who was there. And so getting the perspective of the veteran on the ground is definitely one that we're interested in. And so let's get started with that. John, can you tell us what you saw, what you heard in terms of how immediate feedback from within the paddock and the series seemed to be on the format?
I think overall it was a pretty successful weekend for IndyCar. They accomplished a lot of the objectives that they'd set out to. Certainly Bud Danker from the Penske Corporation, one of his chief hopes for having the doubleheader format, and he was kind of the guy that sparked it, working with Randy Bernard last year, was they really wanted to make the Saturday more of an event. They had the Grand Am, Daytona prototypes, the whole Grand Am series racing there as a support event, as they have for last year. But it seemed that that actually having the headliner perform a race on Saturday as well as Sunday, it really helped the crowd out. The estimates I've seen were 30 to 35,000 on Saturday, which is a pretty good Saturday crowd. They got probably 35 to 40 on Sunday. The Sunday crowd was a little bigger. You got to take it with a grain of salt. I mean, people were joking that, you know, 60 or 70% of the people on the grounds were there were Penske Corporation employees or General Motors employees. And certainly in talking to Roger Penske just before the race, you know, he kept going on about the corporate support. And that was definitely evident there. You know, there was a lot of corporate support, especially from General Motors. Chevrolet had a huge presence, as you'd expect, as a title sponsor. Cadillac had a big presence there as well. The World Challenge Series, the Pirelli World Challenge Series, was one of the other support events. And, of course, Cadillac competes in that with their CTSV cars. So I think that, you know, just from an appearance standpoint, it was a very successful weekend for them. You know, people used to joke about the Detroit Grand Prix, but since Mr. Penske's taken over as the promoter, since they've kind of revived the race in the last 5 or 6 years, of course, they went a couple years where the economy didn't let it happen. It's definitely a nicer presentation than it used to be. The signage is much nicer than you normally see at IndyCar street events. They invested a lot of money in the course this year. Of course, last year they had a lot of problems with the track breaking up and everything. They said they did something like $2 million worth of investments in the track, repaving a lot of the track. They reverted to a longer track layout that they originally used in the last couple of 3 years that CART ran there about 10 or 12 years ago, and that improved the racing quite a bit. The Detroit course has always been notorious for being really difficult to pass on, and by extending a couple of the straights, they did make it more racy for the drivers, and the drivers were very appreciative of that. And there are additional improvements that are planned for next year, too. The whole doubleheader format, I think it was pretty well received by the drivers and the teams. I know Marty Reed on ABC kept bleeding on about how, you know, the drivers are fatigued, and that's why there were so many accidents in the Sunday race. I don't think that had anything to do with it. The track had rubbered in, and I think the guys were kind of told to kind of take it easy on Saturday. They didn't want to stack up a bunch of cars and have guys doing a bunch of all-nighters to get them ready for Sunday. And I think the old red mist kind of took over for some of the guys and girls on Sunday. But effectively, they doubled their television audience. I mean, they split it among 2 days. But if you look at last year's Detroit race, which was, I forget whether it was on NBC Sports or ABC, but they got a 0.7 overnight and a 0.8 overnight. So cumulatively, they got 1.5 in terms of a rating, which is about 2 million viewers. And that's serious progress for them. I mean, obviously, IndyCar's one of their main concerns right now is their television ratings, especially on NBC Sports, where they're only getting 0.2s and pulling in 200,000 or 300,000 viewers. And so if you can go to a sponsor and say, hey, at least we're getting 1 million viewers, it's going to help the general economics of the whole series.
What about any stress on the teams? You mentioned that the drivers were sort of told to take it easy. Some of them didn't manage that. There was Saavedra and Allmendinger both had pretty big issues in the Saturday race, and they were ready to go on Sunday, much to the team's credit. But did you get the sense that there was much stress within the crew members on that end? I think Tagliani as well may have had issues both days. Did you get any sense that it was excessively hard on the teams?
No, I don't think so. You know, in the bad old days of CART, when engines would only go a couple hundred miles and they were changing engines every day, maybe it would have been more of an issue. But the fact that engines go for 2,000 miles these days, and everybody already had their race engine installed prior to the weekend, and unless there was a problem, nobody was going to require an engine change. That's the main concern for crew guys. You know, that adds a couple or 3 hours of work to them. Essentially, there wasn't a whole lot, I would say, different, you know, in prepping the car between qualifying and the race. You know, they probably, based on race conditions, there was probably a tougher cleanup job getting all the bugs and rubber off the cars. But, from my perspective, none of the teams really had anything negative to say about it.
Well, that's good, because certainly going into the weekend, there was a lot of sort of whispered concern that things might not go so smoothly. And we get to see it two more times this year before, well, maybe only one, but by the time that scheduling decisions for next year need to be made. But I think that it'll be interesting to see how it does play out through the rest of the year and see if that trend continues. Paul, you had a question for John?
Yeah, John, being in Detroit, you know, you were mentioning there was a lot of corporate support from GM. I've also seen some rumors that Ford had some representatives dispatched to the event throughout the weekend. Were you able to catch up on any rumors or get a sense of whether Ford was there more of in an exploratory sense and looking at possibly jumping back in IndyCar maybe in a couple, 3 years out from now?
My impression in talking to some of the Ford racing guys over the last year or so is that they do not have a substantial interest in coming back into IndyCar racing, simply because there's not a whole lot of return on investment they could get out of it right now. Yes, there was a minor Ford presence at the race. I think Edsel Ford II was there, but it was more in a ceremonial type affair. Kevin Kennedy, who's one of the chief Ford racing PR guys, was there, but he was basically there, you know, with his wife, just enjoying a weekend off from the NASCAR scene. So, you know, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but I wouldn't hold your breath in looking for Ford to enter IndyCar racing anytime soon. But having said that, I'm certain that they were keeping their eyes open just to see what kind of effect the doubleheader format had. And you can be certain that they're watching IndyCar racing. Obviously, Ford was in IndyCar racing for a long time, partnered with Cosworth, you know, really for 20 years from the 80s up through about 2003, 2004, actually all the way through the end of Champ Car in 07. Not that they were throwing a whole lot of money into that program, but they did have an IndyCar presence with Champ Car up until 6 or 7 years ago. And, you know, it's wishful thinking. I mean, a lot of people really would like to see Ford jump back on board, especially if you could get that notion of Ford versus Chevy as a competing manufacturer. But there's a whole lot more going on. I'm sure your next question is going to venture into this area with the engine manufacturers being tapped to produce aerodynamic kits for the future. You know, the investment is more than just engines these days. They want to differentiate the car so that people just looking can see the difference between a Honda-powered car and a Chevy-powered car. So if you're a manufacturer coming into IndyCar right now, one of the things that we learned over the weekend is that, yeah, the manufacturers are going to be counted on to be the developers and financiers of these aerodynamic kits. And so that's something any manufacturer coming in, whether it's Ford, Audi, or, you know, just pulling out of your butt, Kia or whoever, that they're going to have to account for.
And of course, we do want to talk to you in detail about the announcement of the competition strategy over the next few years. But just before we get into that, of course, you mentioned that there was the Grand-Am race on Saturday, and two things that I think are safe to assume from sitting at home on the couch. One is that the Grand-Am race would have felt heavily swept under the rug with everything that was happening with IndyCar for the weekend. And two, I think it's very safe to assume that this is not one of the events that's going to make the cut for the United Sports Car Racing Series for next year. If you're the events promoter, based on what you saw this weekend, what are you pushing for in terms of what happens next year? Do you see it now as being a serious liability to lose that and lose the doubleheader going into 2014? And if not given the option, how successful do you think this one can continue to be? I mean, other than the fact that there's the massive corporate support that's never going to go away, of course.
Well, in terms of the doubleheader format, Bud Denker, who's, you know, Roger Penske's guy, the main man behind the Detroit Grand Prix, Bud Denker's already on record saying that he's going to be lobbying to have the doubleheader again next year. He was extremely happy with what they achieved at the gate and through the corporate support and everything. He feels the doubleheader format really helped that out. I actually, you know, I'm well on record as being not a fan of the Grand Am and the Daytona prototypes, but having said that, and I think it was one of the, he's not a blogger anymore, but Tony DeZinna, who's doing some work for NBCSports.com now, he pointed out today that the American series that are not NASCAR really could benefit each other if they did band together. And I'm in agreement with that, especially with a unified sports car series next year. Even if they really want the Daytona prototypes to be the leading class, and if they neuter the real prototypes, if you will, the ALMS branded cars now, I think that it can only benefit IndyCar if there is a strong American sports car series that runs races in conjunction with IndyCar. You're only going to add fans to the equation. I think we've seen that over the last few years that the races, not so much the races that have Grand Am and IndyCar combined, but certainly the ALMS ones, whether it's Long Beach or Mid-Ohio, that having sports cars on the bill, if it's a popular sports car series, it helps IndyCar out. The perception of just having grandstands full on two or three days of a race weekend, it just makes it look like a more popular, more successful event. So I would be hopeful that the United Sports Car Racing Series would have as many twin bills with IndyCar as possible next year. I think it'll only benefit them both. And with regard to that, and this gets back to the Ford question too, Ford is on record. They're going to do an engine for Daytona prototypes next year. You know, Ford's got a minor presence in the series right now. They're running V8 engines in the Mike Shank cars, but Ford is actually doing a turbo V6 engine for Grand Am or whatever you want to call the United Sports Car Series next year. So Ford will have a stronger sports car presence next year. And whether that's, you know, a precursor of them getting back an IndyCar down the line, who knows? But if you've got a sports car and IndyCar twin bill and Ford's part of it through the sports car side, that only helps IndyCar.
Well, you had an article on ESPN.com this week with where you were very clear about your thoughts about the press conference that happened with Derek Walker over the weekend, outlining IndyCar's plan right into 2021 for their technical developments and what they envision as being the process of competition strategy going forward from here. Do you want to just sort of very quickly summarize your thoughts from that article, and then we'll sort of dig into that in more detail?
Well, sure, Steph. We have to be realistic. We're not going to go back to the 1980s or the 1990s. We're not going to have a Penske chassis and a Swift and a Lola and a Reynard and a Dallara and a, you know, an Eagle and everything else. We're not going to have genuine chassis competition, certainly, in IndyCar racing for the foreseeable future. We think it's progress that at least we've got two engine manufacturers now, and hopefully we've got other engine manufacturers who are interested in joining the series at some point in the near future. But I came away from the whole affair somewhat disappointed because it wasn't stated, but the underlying message that we were given is that the basic Dallara DW12 package is going to be a 10-year car.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even if you go back to the original IRL from 1997, they were doing chassis on a three-year basis. The first IRL chassis was 97 to 99. Then they had one from 2000 to 2002. The next one, the IR03, was meant to be a three-year car as well. But, of course, they kept waiting for, you know, the open wheel split to end. And so they just kind of kept pushing back, bringing on a new car, a new formula or whatever. And what we ended up with was the IR03 being used for 9 years. And a lot of people were really appalled by that, you know, 9 years with the same basic car with almost no visual changes and no technical changes. IndyCar came out and they told us, yeah, we're going to do a new floor for the car next year to kind of prevent this lift problem that the car seems to have, the way it flips up on its side in oval accidents. They're going to allow the manufacturers to do aero kits of their own in 2015, assuming they jump on board for it. They want to do engine and tire development for 2016 with the goal of doing a new lap record at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for the 100th running of the Indianapolis 516. But if you kind of read between the lines, they basically told us that we're going to be using the DW12, even if it gets a new body in 2018 or 2019, they're going to be using the same basic chassis for 10 years. And to me, that is incredibly disheartening. For someone who really enjoyed when I was growing up saying, you know, wow, look at the Penske PC10 compared to the PC9. What a big difference that is. Or, you know, hey, look at the new rear wing that Reynard's brought this week. Anybody who was hoping for open competition or real, you know, opening the door for more serious technical development, whether it was from the manufacturers or from the teams, had to come away from that whole announcement sorely disappointed. Yes, they want to see the cars get faster and do a lap record at the Speedway. But at the same time, they're going to be doing it with the same old car. And, you know, there's probably 100 reasons why IndyCar racing has faded as it has in the last 20 years or so. But one of them is the fact that there is no technological innovation anymore. And they're kind of throwing the fans a bone, but I think they're making more out of what the series perceives as innovation and change than what the fans are hoping for.
But, John, on that note, if what they're calling the DW12 is essentially the tub and, you know, some of the internal mechanical pieces, but allowing the external, the skin of it to change through these aero kits, whether it's the engine manufacturer kits that come on board in 15 or this Dallara kit that'll come on board with either in 18 or 19, I forget which one it was. Doesn't that give some of the development that you're talking about, though, back into the equation? I mean, is the tub itself and some of those internal pieces, are those critical components to what a lot of people are considering development of the race car and year-to-year development?
Well, I agree with you on that front. You know, changing the tub doesn't need to happen on a yearly basis. I mean, if I worked with Reynard back in the 90s, and the 94 and 95 Reynard tubs were identical. The 96 tub was a new tub because of increased cockpit protection, and then they had another cockpit protection rule change for 97 that necessitated another new tub for 97. But that 97 tub essentially was the tub that Reynard used for the rest of that car's lifespan, which went up through 2002. So, yeah, putting its side pods, wings, engine cover, you know, there's still people out there that are furious that the DW12 has what looks like an airbox on it. If you can change the look of it, I think that's going to appease people. And then you're right. You know, the basic tub doesn't necessarily have to change. But at the same time, it's just the appearance of a lack of change. The fact that if you get to 2019 and you're using a tub that debuted in 2012, it just doesn't speak volumes about advancing the sport or advancing things and making things new and different. I understand it's all economy driven and everything, but It's who are you going to go after? I've always had a theory that IndyCar should be going after the old fans, the fans that cared about the sport back when, and it's easier to bring them back and get them interested in things than it would be to new fans. You've got to do both, obviously. But there was a pretty large fan base for IndyCar racing 10 or 15 years ago, and it always strikes me that it'd be easier to kind of rejuvenate those people's interest than it would be to just pick some people off the street and say, hey, check this out. And it's the purists, it's the hardcore people like myself who I think are the more interested in substantial change rather than this heavily regulated incremental change.
And an extension of that, something that left me scratching my head, was when Derek Walker started talking about 18 and 19 again, when he talked about, well, maybe at that time we'll go to a new engine architecture as well. Something I didn't understand really is, I mean, this engine architecture seems to be working fairly well now. It's not what you call cheap by any means, but you're talking about 2,000-mile rebuilds, which is pretty impressive. They've got pretty good power for a 2.2-liter V6 on there. I don't understand IndyCar's line of thinking, like, we have to have an engine change, an architecture change in the future. How long has NASCAR been running the same V8 blocks as they did? How long did CART, USAC, and Champ Car run a 2.6-liter V8? To me, it just seems like they're already setting themselves up to do something completely different when there's no proof that the engine architecture needs to be changed. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, you make a good point there. I mean, the 2.65-liter turbo V8 era essentially went from the early 70s up to the, all the way up through 2007 in Champ Car, and it served them pretty well. I mean, obviously, by the end, a 2.65-liter turbo V8, they were pretty well detuned. Remember that the Champ Car, they were the first ones with the Ford Cosworth that came out in 03. They were the first ones that kind of abolished the "we must develop all the time" theory and put more stringent regulations in place and mileages and things like that. I think they were getting 1,200 miles out of those Cosworth XFEs that they brought out in 2003, as opposed to, they were getting, 450 miles, unless it was a 500-mile race. They were getting 450 mile life out of their engines prior to 2003. That 2.65 turbo engine, it worked really well for them for a long time. It sounded sweet. It became reliable. I mean, you could certainly do a 2,000-mile version of that engine right now. And I posted a picture on Facebook of the 2000 Michigan 500, mm-hmm. that fantastic race between Juan Montoya and Michael Andretti. And I said, we're talking about doing 240 at Indy. Why don't you just dust off some 2000 Lowells and Reynards with Cosworth and Hondas, and you could do it tomorrow with, minimal expense and minimal hassle. But I think there's a perception that that would be going back to the past. And I think that, certainly one of the hallmarks of the auto industry itself these days is downsizing engines and fewer cylinders. It's, some people think it's fortunate that the Corvette C7 that just came out still had a V8. There are a lot of people thinking that it was going to be a V6 turbo, and there's talk that the next generation of Mustang that we're going to see in a year or two won't have a V8 in it. So that's obviously the way to the future, and I think IndyCar realizes that part of whatever they do going forward, it has to have relevance to street car technology, and it has to have some form of green relevance as well. And I think the thinking being that if you're getting 700 horsepower now out of a 2.2-liter turbo V6, and if you allow the manufacturers to develop it a little bit and maybe get up to 800 or 850 and still getting the same kind of life out of them that they are now, or slightly reduced life in exchange for that additional power, that by the time you get to 2018 or 2019, that if you want to maintain that same sort of power level and bring in whatever modern technologies are relevant at the time, you're probably going to want to update the engine formula again at that point in time, just for the perception of being current with the times.
Mm-hmm. John, I'm going to make a statement, and I want you to tell me whether you agree or disagree with it. IndyCar racing right now, in terms of competitiveness within the field, is about as good as we have ever seen. That statement I would agree with. Yes. With that said, IndyCar can have all of the great competition and great racing that it wants, but it's not going to do anything to attract fans. There needs to be some technical innovation demonstrated to bring people in. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I would agree just because of the fact that they've had great racing, for the last few years. It was decent enough in the last couple of years of the IR03. It's been quite good in the year and a half that we've used the DW12. But you have to realize that some of the reason that it's so close and competitive is that it's spec car racing.
Mm-hmm.
If every chassis is the same and every engine is the same as it was up through 2011, and they're all in the same tires, then of course they're all going to be virtually equal.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that is that Americans, we've kind of been brainwashed by NASCAR into thinking that close racing is king. Mm-hmm. You have to have a pack of cars racing around, you know, in tight quarters, and there has to be side-by-side racing all the time, and there has to be a photo finish. And NASCAR is responsible for that kind of brainwashing of race fans. And I don't agree with that. I mean, for one thing, I thought the pack racing that the IRL had with the old formula was incredibly dangerous. I thought it was a miracle that they never put a car in the grandstands. I mean, yeah, they did actually a few times, but nobody got hurt. Mainly because the grandstands were empty, thankfully. And it's the one time you want to say that we're glad that, you know, that they didn't have a huge crowd because people could have gotten hurt. But we've lost track of the fact that part of racing is about technical excellence. It is about one team developing a better mousetrap than the next. And the teams have been prevented from doing that. The manufacturers have been prevented from doing that in the modern era. You know, it comes down to economy. They're trying to save these teams and manufacturers from themselves and just from spending themselves into oblivion. So what we've got is we've got this close racing, but it's very artificial. It's artificial because why wouldn't it be close if all the cars are the same? We've got two engine manufacturers now, but the engine rules are so tightly regulated that every effort is made to make the two engines as equal as possible. It's essentially trying to apply the spec racing formula to competing engine manufacturers. I mean, we should be thankful that the Chevy's a twin turbo and the Honda is a single, that there's actually some minor differences between the two. I think people have lost track of the fact that part of what racing was always about was developing and building a better car. And it's always been my opinion that if you do that, if you do develop and build a better car and you do a better job, that you shouldn't be penalized for that. Your competition should have to just work harder to beat you. And this whole mentality of spec car racing and NASCAR, you know, it's, you know, if the Chevys were faster than the Fords, then they'd give the Fords a break or whatever. It's permeated IndyCar racing. And it's one of the reasons I never really enjoyed the whole IRL era. I thought it was all very contrived and everything. And it's my opinion that if you open it up to let the teams work on the cars again, to let the manufacturers have a little leeway and freedom to do what they want. Yeah, we might not get a photo finish every week, but we're going to get a different type of quality racing that might appeal to a different fan.
Right.
Obviously, you know, we've seen this close racing. We've seen these miracle finishes, you know, through the IRL from 1997 to the present, and it still hasn't connected with the public, and it still hasn't made them tune in. You know, there was a lot of animosity toward the formation of the IRL, and I'm sure that's a huge reason why a lot of people ignored it for a long time. But IndyCar racing has been back together for the last 5 years, and it still isn't gaining any real traction with the public. And you know, maybe race fans are smarter than we think they are. Maybe they understand that spec car racing is just kind of a bogus concept, and they want to see real racing again.
Right. One more question for you, and then we'll let you go. From what you know of the regulations surrounding the DW12, do you think that the aero kits are going to have any kind of practical performance difference between them, or do you think that they're more just kind of eye candy to provide visual differentiation?
IndyCar will do everything they can to make sure the performance between these body kits is as closely matched as possible because they want to keep the close racing that we've seen with everybody running the same car. The manufacturers, more than anything else, are pushing to do the body kits because, I mean, the cars sound the same right now. Let's face it, they all look the same because they all are the same in terms of the side pods and wings and everything that they run on them. The engines are slightly different in their turbo configurations, but they sound identical. You have to be literally a trained expert to stand trackside and tell the difference between a Honda and a Chevrolet. But the manufacturers want the average race fan to see a car go by on the track and say, okay, that's a Chevy. That's a Honda. That's an Audi or whatever. So the manufacturers are definitely the driving force behind the body kits, and it's a good thing. I think brand recognition is an important part. I can understand why the manufacturers would want fans to instantly recognize who has what kind of car. So you can call it eye candy or whatever, but there are genuine reasons why it's being done. A, to help the competition to, you know, maybe just bring out a little differentiation on the track as well as in the way the cars look. And the manufacturers definitely want the cars to look different, to have brand identity.
Okay. Well, we won't keep you any longer because we know you have places to be. So thank you so much for your insight. It's excellent as always. I'm sure that our listeners will greatly appreciate it. And yeah, thank you. Greatly appreciate your time. And we'll see you at the track later this year.
Anytime. I hope to see you guys out there soon.
For sure. Thank you, John. Always great to have John on the show. He's always got lots of inside view, let's put it that way. I know a lot of people don't tend to agree with his opinions at times, but he comes from a certain side, and everybody comes from a certain side and has their own opinions, and, you know, at least he's honest, forthcoming.
Yeah, very honest. John and I have disagreed on a number of occasions, but I think there's certainly no doubt that he's passionate about the sport. He has very well-formed opinions, has been around for many, many, many years. You know, I think there are a lot of people that still see him as a bit of a kart or champ car cheerleader. But to his credit, John has given the IndyCar series and the IRL before that, he's given them a lot of good press. And, you know, I certainly value John's opinions.
Yeah. Well, let's move on and take a look at some of the other things that happened throughout the weekend. Let's start by getting the messy stuff out of the way. Did you see that Twitter fight between Randy Bernard and Panther Racing?
How could I not? They kind of drew you into it.
I somehow got drawn into the middle of this.
You and Randy are so tight. That's the problem.
I just made an offhanded comment to Randy about how, yeah, well, that wasn't the best way to handle his PR, was it? And then all of a sudden I'm getting retweeted. Being associated with calling John Barnes a complete arrogant buffoon.
That's what it was, an arrogant buffoon.
Yes.
Job, Steph. Way to go.
Randy Bernard may have some residual feelings about John Barnes, but...
Wait a second, though. Just think about that, though. Randy Bernard got fired as CEO, and he's still watching the IndyCar series. He's still engaging with the fans. He's still staying in tune with it.
And he's able to say whatever he wants because he's already fired, so he can't get fired again.
Wait, isn't he still an advisor, though, to IndyCar? Quote, unquote, still an advisor?
He was until he got the other job and they were able to fully sever his contract. I don't think that's the case anymore.
Yeah, so now he's just a fan.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah, offering his opinion straight up. Can't say, well, in principle, in the principle behind what Randy was saying, I certainly see his point of view. I don't think that that situation with John Barnes could possibly have been handled any worse. And it is a shame because it would have been nice to know what happened there, but I don't think very many people were surprised. So,
no. And maybe we should catch up the listeners just in case they didn't catch what happened.
Right. So what happened was during practice on Saturday, another friend of the More Front Wing podcast, Jake Query of the IMS Radio Network, went up to John Barnes during the session to ask to have him on the air and ask him some questions and put him on the spot about what had happened with the situation of Briscoe being in the car for this weekend and J.R. Hildebrand being out, and was told it was none of your business, quote unquote.
On the air.
On the air, yes. Not exactly exactly great, as we said, press relations and public relations, but, I mean...
Some days you just really feel bad for Mike Kitchell, don't you?
I was about to say the exact same thing for him.
it's just, you know, I guess I'm not surprised coming from John Barnes, but, yeah, it's one of those things you just shake your head and you think, you know, the IndyCar series isn't, you know, just flooded with media these days. It's not like it's everywhere you turn. So when you are approached by somebody trying to get information about your team out there, look, I understand it's not a kittens and rainbows type subject that they probably are real excited to talk about, but still, you made a business decision, a public business decision. And not only, you know, is your team in the public spotlight, but your sponsor is basically the United States government. I mean, you have a little bit of responsibility to, A, represent that sponsor well, and, B, be held accountable for the actions that you are directly responsible for while representing that entity. So, yeah, for him to just come out and say, yeah, it's none of your business who the U.S. government is basically sponsoring. No, John, it kind of is.
Mm-hmm. You know the worst part about that whole scenario was? This all went down on poor Mike Kitchell's birthday.
I know. Poor guy.
Not just awful. Anyway, here's another fun IMS Radio Network related subject. It starts out with Jenna Fryer's article. Did you read that?
Give me a little more.
The article where she basically revealed all these secrets about how everybody in the paddock is angry with race control and outlining some of the poor decisions that race control had made, that that the paddock was questioning, and how everybody's stomping around complaining about the blocking in Brazil and all of this.
I got bits and pieces of that, though I have a feeling where you're going with this is probably not the article itself.
No, it's not, but the article is still floating around out there. Of course, Jenna Fryer works for Associated Press, so if you just Google Associated Press, Jenna Fryer, Brazil blocking, you'll probably find it. It was posted in news aggregators around the country on Saturday, and it was late Saturday, and the response to it came through IMS Radio Network on Sunday morning during the Sunday morning warm-up, in which Mike King decided to spend the entire half hour suddenly complaining or talking about how the entire paddock complains all the time about race control. And he actually had the gall to say on the air, and I quote, "I cannot think of a time when so many people have been so frustrated with race control." And I actually tweeted at the time, "Really, Mike?" Because that's some pretty selective revisionist history that you're doing there.
We're not talking about New Hampshire a couple years ago, are we?
Oh, you don't think so. Hello?
I don't know. Just maybe.
Or, on a slightly more serious note, how about the decision to race at Las Vegas? People weren't very happy with race control about that either.
Okay.
So anyway,
I'm going to lay off.
Yeah, it's not a nice road to go down. But anyway, there have been a lot more serious issues with the previous administration than there have been so far with this one. There have been with this one. There will be with everyone. Nobody wants Bo Barfield's job, and that's for a really good reason. But that whole diatribe that Mike King did on Sunday morning just was the most disgusting display of agenda that I've ever seen or heard in my life. It was awful. And if I had another option for catching practice and qualifying sessions, I would use it, because I was that turned off by the whole thing. It was hideous.
I did not actually get to hear the rant. I was on the road at the time, but when I reached my destination that morning, I, of course, first thing I do is look on Twitter. And usually, you know, on a morning warm up, you'll have, you know, in my stream, I'll have a certain number of tweets to flip through to kind of get the headline information, if you will. That morning, I probably had five times the normal number of tweets that I would have to go through. And as I kept going through it, it was Mike King, MK, what are you talking about? Mike King, Mike King, Mike King. And it was just over and over and over again. And it took a little while before I could kind of piece together what had happened. But it became very obvious very quickly that he had certainly gotten on his soapbox, and my understanding is he defended Bo in the sense that he was placing the blame on the rest of the people, saying that they're just whiny and complaining about everything.
That wasn't the sense that I took away from it at all.
Okay, then
I took away from it was that he felt that the previous iteration of race control had done a better job.
So he was actually laying the blame on Bo himself, not necessarily the people complaining about it.
That was my interpretation of it. I suppose there was room for interpretation, but that was certainly my take from it. Now, yes. I'm not, let's be honest here, Mike King's biggest fan myself. And so it's possible.
Or he of yours.
Right? And so it's possible that I read some of that interpretation into it on my own as some pre-existing bias. I'll be very upfront about that. But my feeling from interacting with others that morning was that it was not solely my opinion that that was what was happening.
And that's very well could be the case. As I said, I did not hear the rampage personally, so I'm kind of going off what I've been able to gather. I do know that Mike and I have conversed often in the past, and I know he is a fan of Brian Barnhart, or maybe fan isn't the correct word, but he certainly stood by Brian during a number of his calls during his tenure. I guess I'll say it politically nicely. So I don't know if he still has that allegiance somewhat toward Brian, and I don't, maybe he's a little bit jaded toward Bo. I don't know. I haven't spoken to Mike directly about Bo Barfield, so I don't know what his opinion of it, and I certainly don't intend to put words in his mouth or thoughts into his mind. But I do know that he was a proponent of Brian Barnhart, so I'm not surprised to hear of this jaded rant against him.
Well, I've been pretty gentle with Mike King in the past, and so I'm going to make a couple of points here, and then I'm going to move on because this is already going to get me into pretty big trouble. But for one thing, if somebody had been tuning in to something in more depth than just a race for the first time that morning, catching the morning warm-up on IndyCar.com just to see what it was about, they would never do it again. It was a complete and total embarrassment to the sport. And for a second point, for some reason, he seems to continue to keep his job, despite the fact that in broadcasting school, one of the first things that they teach you is if you're going to be speaking about a sport or providing a color commentary of something that's happening on a screen in front of you, nobody wants your opinion. Your job is to tell us to translate what you're seeing to radio and tell us what's happening on the track. And it's very rare these days that that's actually what happens during a session that anybody watches on IndyCar.com. And if he seems to somehow keep his job, good for him. But somebody's got to talk to the guy because it's just getting out of hand. It's ridiculous. And it's such a turnoff, and it should not be allowed to continue. And let's leave it at that. Let's talk about the actual racing. Would that be fun?
Yes. Racing. I like racing.
Yeah. So do you think we'll see AJ Allmendinger again?
Ooh, he certainly had a tough weekend, that's for sure.
He did. Wow. Now, Roger has been at times very forgiving. Not to mention very forgiving of AJ Allmendinger coming up to this point. And so we have to think that maybe there's some potential there that he'll get another chance, but gosh, it was an expensive weekend. And the announcement was made during the weekend that he's going to be running the nationwide races at Road America in Mid-Ohio, and so that's another door that may be opening for him. Maybe that's the direction he wants to go. Maybe he'll be like I almost said Ron Fellows there, but that might be an unfair comparison. But maybe he'll be one of those guys that only runs the tin tops on the road courses, and that might work out for him. Don't know. I guess only time will tell, but certainly it was not a very nice weekend for AJ Allmendinger. Let's take a look at the dichotomy of the two races that we were given this weekend. So on Saturday, we had this race that kind of was not all that exciting. I think it was actually more exciting than it looked on ABC. So let's tackle that topic first. ABC, what do we do about this booth? Because I swear it sounded like you tuned in and you were watching a golf tournament. It was brutal. It just couldn't get excited about anything.
No, and
race two was better. Race two was a little bit better, but race one, break out the NyQuil boys.
And everyone really thought that bringing Eddie Cheever back on board for a full season was going to help out the team overall, but yeah, it was tough. It was tough to get through that.
Didn't get worked up when Sebastian Savager flipped the double angry birds.
Yeah, all we got was a
That will be an FCC fine.
Yeah, we apologize for that.
Oh jeez. It's just I just don't even know and this is supposed to be the stretch of time where IndyCar is supposed to gain all its traction, right? The whole plan under Randy Bernard was to lump all the ABC races together so that we could build some momentum and get people to start watching the NBC races, get them to continue on through the rest of the season so that they can all drop off during the big gaps in the season at the end of July and in September. But anyway, and I just don't know, It needs to have a much deeper discussion than we can get into here, but the question has come up again, and it's a valid one, of whether good, solid commentary and broadcast values on a small network that don't get a lot of viewers is a better venue for growth than network coverage that makes you want to do horrible things to yourself? It's really a tough question, because it's hard not to look at the ABC product right now and wonder whether it's actually damaging the sport. You know, John mentioned the overnights of the 0.7 and the 0.8 on the weekend, and people in IndyCar, you know, they put out a press release about it and talked about how it was an improvement, but we're talking about tens of thousands of people improvement. This is not good enough, and it's not happening fast enough. And I hope that it's not that people are putting all of their eggs in the turbo basket, because I don't think that that's the right strategy either. But it does seem to be the case to a degree.
Yeah, it's right now the IndyCar series is in a tough position, because you know they are getting paid by NBC Sports Network to carry their races. NBC Sports Network has a really good crew that gels well. The problem is they're just not reaching the people. You know, you're reaching 2 to 3 times as many people on the, if not more, on the ABC side.
But if you're not retaining them because the broadcasts are so bad, then what good are you doing by losing that continuity?
Yeah, I totally agree.
It's a really tough question. I mean, anybody who's ever had any sort of involvement in television will tell you that network exposure is the holy grail. It's what everybody aims for and works toward. But, you know, if it's being presented as sort of an afterthought, it's a tough thing to justify. The upshot of it is that the people that are producing your broadcast for your sport for you, they need to care. And you don't get the sense that this group cares. You get the sense that they come in, they collect their paycheck, and they go home.
Well, then take that a bit further. What's IndyCar's option? Does IndyCar have the ability to say to ESPN that, hey, look, these guys just aren't cutting it?
You got to think that if they did, they would have done it 5 years ago.
You would think so.
I don't know how much say exactly that they have. And it's got a lot to do with who works for ABC and what talent pool they have to draw from as well. But I don't know. There's another one of those guys who seems to keep his job and nobody really quite knows why. And it's a bizarre situation. They just don't seem all that interested in hearing the calls for change. So
you wonder if anyone's there is even really paying attention.
Yeah. It's hard to say without being in the middle of it, but let's look at a positive from the Saturday race and Mike Conway's win. Now, here's a question for you, Paul. If you're a casual fan tuning in maybe for the first or second time, maybe you saw Tony Kanaan win the Indy 500 this year and you thought that was pretty cool and pretty exciting, so you thought you'd check out Detroit and see what it was like. And then you find out that this guy that won this race today is a guy that was a part-time driver for the team, got on a plane on Thursday with the ink still wet on his contract, jumps in this car and wins for one of the teams that puts their cars together with Cheerio packets and duct tape. If you're the new fan taking in the sport for the first time, what impression of IndyCar does that leave you?
I don't know. I've kind of wrestled with this.
Truth of it is that there's such a great amount of talent out in this field right now, and he managed to come out above all of that. But on his face, this doesn't look that way.
It doesn't look what way, you mean?
It doesn't look as though he had to overcome all the challenge of a really diverse and deeply talented field.
Yeah, it wasn't like he just barely beat them.
No.
I mean, he laid the smack down.
He did.
Badly.
But it looks like a really bizarre situation, and like IndyCar is a bunch of dinky cars running around in circles that anybody can walk into and win. It's kind of a rough deal.
Yeah, from that standpoint, it certainly doesn't look good, you know. And I remember having a conversation with another of our IndyCar site people that run another website at Indianapolis. We had the same conversation about AJ Allmendinger coming in. You know, what if he would have come in and, you know, gotten a top 2 or 3 finish at Indianapolis? you know, he's a mid-pack at best NASCAR driver. Well, I guess that's probably not fair. Mid to front, I guess, in some situations. But he hops in a car with a few days of testing, and all of a sudden he's able to run right up front in what's considered one of the more difficult races. What would that have said?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is an interesting way to look at things, and maybe it's an extension of what John was saying earlier when we all talk about how great the racing is now and how close it is. Well, maybe that is simply a result of the spec racing. You have the same engines, more or less. I mean, you got, which, by the way, we'll get to this maybe a little bit later if we have time, but kudos to Honda, who have turned it around mm-hmm. in a hurry. Wow, did they lay? They...
Yeah, 5 out of 6 podium spots for them this weekend in Chevrolet's hometown.
That did not sit well with the folks
no.
at GM, I'm sure. But, you know, essentially you're driving the same cars on the same tires with very similarly, easy for me to say, matched engines. So maybe that's why we're seeing such parity and diversity here. I don't think it's a complete disconnect there. But Mike Conway, to his credit, has shown many times that he's very good on these road and street courses. He showed earlier this year at Long Beach when he hopped in a Ray Hall Letterman car and drove the wheels off it at Long Beach. Unfortunately, got taken out about midway in that race, if I recall, from electrical gremlin, I think, is what happened. His results didn't show it, but he ran extremely well that weekend. So, you know, I'm not surprised that he came in, but certainly I see your point that if somebody tuned in, you know, for the first or second time and they see this journeyman who's, you know, decided he doesn't want to run ovals anymore in an IndyCar, all of a sudden he flies in for the weekend and picks up a win on Saturday and, you know, probably could have won easily on Sunday as well, had some strategy gone his way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What does that say?
It doesn't help that he hopped out of his car on Saturday and went, yeah, I'm really excited. I'd like to thank the team. I'd like to thank Honda. And come on, get excited.
Yeah.
You just won a freaking race. Jeez.
Yeah. First race in, what, 2 years, I guess?
Yeah, as Prestog likes to say, his pulse elevated to a whole whopping 40 beats per minute when he hopped out of that car. Jeez. Yeah. It's brutal. Yeah. But
some
that's not
just aren't that excitable.
No, and it's a topic that's going to come up again as we start to go through race two, which was kind of the exact opposite of Saturday, as it turned out. But at the same time, it was two very different races because everybody was just driving like a bunch of friggin' idiots until that huge carnage front on the front stretch halfway through. And then all of a sudden, they all got their heads screwed on, right? And it was some of the best racing we've ever seen at Belle Isle. It was bizarre. Now, we had – let me just pull up something here because it's been sort of touched on, all of the firsts and all of the milestones that we reached in this race. But I wrote them down in the First Impressions article that we posted on Sunday, so I just want to whip through them here. First IndyCar win for Simon Pagenaud. First IndyCar win for Sam Schmidt. First IndyCar win for Damon Hamilton as a team owner or otherwise. 3 different teams represented on the podium on Sunday, and not one of them was Penske Ganassi or Andretti Car, and that was for the second time this year. Oh, and by the way, through 7 races, we've had 6 different winners representing 6 different nationalities on 5 different teams.
And the 5th consecutive race with a podium sans Penske or Ganassi.
Yes.
Can we officially say the red car era is over?
For now.
For
it's
now.
It's bound to return.
Well, maybe.
I think it's hard to say because I can't really go around saying, oh yeah, they're going to figure out the aero kits and be miles ahead of everybody else when I've been all turning around and on the other side saying that the aero kits are going to make no difference and they're going to be lipstick on a pig, right? So I guess we'll see. But I do think that when we get into a couple of years of this car, possibly don't tell him I said this, Dario Franchitti potentially aside because he just cannot seem to get this thing fully figured out. He has sort of halfway okay weekends once in a while. I think he finished 5th in one of the races this weekend.
Yeah, Ganassi had a 4th and a 5th on the second race.
Yeah, and but most of the time he just doesn't seem to be able to put it together with this car, and so I don't know if that's ever quite going to happen. But I think what these teams have shown in the past is that what they need to start winning races again is a little bit of time and a lot of money. And so I don't think it'll be too long before we start seeing it come around again because a little bit of extra time of testing and in the tunnel always seems to bring things back around eventually to the natural order of things. But it sure is a whole lot of fun right now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but you say that, but typically, you know, let's look at Champ Car in 2007 when they shuffled the deck. You know, it was much more diverse, I guess you would say, in Champ Car in 07 than it was in 06 when Newman Haas won pretty much everything. You know, in 07, Newman Haas was still winning. They were still competitive. You just had a couple other teams. You had, you know, Derek Walker's team. Help me out here. The Minardi team. You know, they were running up front then as well. But now, I mean, Ganassi's just not there. Ganassi's not there. Penske's really not there. It's not like Will Power is even coming close to finishing on the podium.
Yeah.
They don't. At this point, Penske and Ganassi don't need to just separate themselves from the group. They're almost to the point now where you have to say they have to catch up to the group. And if you're talking about Andretti, you probably are saying that Penske and Ganassi need to play a little bit of catch up.
Which is not something that any of us would ever have imagined that we'd be saying at this point in a year and a half into the DW12.
No, and I certainly would never have ever, ever put money on the fact that we would be going into Texas the ninth race of the year, and that Will Power...
Eighth
race of the year?
Yes.
That was the ninth. Eighth. Okay, eighth race. That Will Power would be going into the race tied for 15th in the points, tied with Joseph Newgarden, 1 point of Simona DiSilvestro, trailing Graham Rahal by four points, who's had not a great year, trailing EJ Viso by 6 points, as well as James Jakes.
Hey, you want to talk about fun point statistics, by the way? Here's a fun one that I rustled up while I was putting together last week's event summary. There are two full-time drivers that have fewer points than Mike Conway right now.
Ooh, yeah, that's kind of painful.
Yeah, not so good. We won't name them because we don't want to make any enemies, but you guys can go and find them if you like. They're in our event summary.
That's at morefrontwing.com/event summary.
That's right. Well done, like Paul.
Thank you.
Yes, I see what you did there. Very good. So here's one bone that I have to pick with IndyCar at the moment. Did you see today that Will Power is getting a penalty for throwing his gloves at Sebastian Bourdais?
That was the lamest thrown gloves I've ever seen in my life.
Okay, well, without inserting commentary about whether it was a well-executed throw of the gloves, what are they thinking?
Why
would they want to discourage the one thing that's truly missing from the sport that will capture the general interest of the public right now, and that's rivalry? Why would they want to discourage that? I was angry enough that they finally found Will Power and put him on TV, and all he could come up with was, oh, Sebastian Bourdais used to be a champ, and now he's just a chump. Come on, Will. I know you can do better than that. I've heard you do better than
certainly
that.
Certainly drop a wanker in there or something.
Oh, just it's brutal. And then they go and take the one thing that he did do that was SportsCenter worthy, and they friggin' penalize him for it to discourage people from doing it again. It's like they couldn't try harder not to get national attention. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Guys, you can't. It's a sport, it's competition, it's emotion. You can't be vanilla as hard as you want to try to please your sponsors and your partners. They're going to be a lot happier if there are more eyeballs watching, and the only way that you're going to get more eyeballs watching is if you let these drivers freaking have emotions and show that they care about what they're doing. I'll take a breath now.
How much did Will get fined at New Hampshire a couple of years ago for his double bird salute, by the way?
I don't believe he did. And that's another distinction that I wanted to make, actually. That was that one on ABC or ESPN? I don't remember if... Because Saavedra was fined because it was on ABC, from what I understand.
Why does that make a difference?
Because it's network as opposed to cable channel. It's controlled by different... That's an FCC thing. That's got nothing to do with IndyCar. But that's the thing about that versus... And the Saavedra penalty... Sorry, the Bourdais penalty, which we'll get to in a minute, versus what Will Power did. And there's no distinction being made here, and there should be. NASCAR's whole deal is if the drivers want to get into each other That's great. That's good for ratings. We'll go, you know, do what you like, but don't diss the series or any of its representatives. You will get into trouble for that. And so I don't have an enormous problem with IndyCar taking the same tack. I do think it's probably not a great thing to have drivers dissing race control in the press or to whoever will listen. That's, as Derek Walker said very aptly at the end of Jenna Fryer's article, that's not good for the series to have the attention on those areas. It should be on the drivers and the racing. But if drivers want to draw attention to each other by getting mad at each other and saying, you know, dissy things about, dissy is not a word, I just made that up, saying dissy things about each other in on camera, then go for it. It's, that's the distinction. And so I don't have an enormous problem with them penalizing Sebastian Bourdais for his post-race comments to race control, as was announced today. I just want to know what they were.
By the way?
Yeah. Do we know what he said?
Yeah. Is this the whole, you know, if the tree falls in the wood, does it really make a sound?
Huh? What are you getting at?
Well, if nobody knows what Sebastian said, I mean, I haven't heard, you haven't heard, it wasn't.
Yeah, really, penalizing him just makes us want to know, right?
Yeah, this is like, dude, the NASCAR penalty a few months ago. Remember where the guy wasn't even on the record or during an interview to be public.
Oh, yeah, Jeremy Clements, when he made that racial slur, but yeah that was a bit silly, too.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not condoning racial slurs by any stretch of the imagination here. But if it is a, if it's a statement that never makes it out,
mm-hmm.
what are you penalizing them for?
Yeah. It's the same thing as the John Barnes thing, right? John Barnes drew more attention to himself by saying none of your business than he would have by just honestly answering the question.
Yeah.
In Bourdais, now people are chasing, trying to figure out what exactly it was he said. And I'm sure that Jenna Fryer will have this big, you know, to do on Twitter when she finds out what it was. And people will go, oh, I can't believe he said that, and draw more attention to it than if it had just been let go.
That or the exact opposite, where it's like, really? That's it?
Yeah.
Well, 30 grand for that, or 10 or whatever he got.
Either way, it's negative attention.
Yeah.
Can I tell you something? Nobody who's listening to this podcast right now is allowed to say I don't do anything for you. I plunged the depths of crap wagon trying to find out what the heck Sebastian Bourdais said, okay?
Could have told me, I would have done that.
It hurt my heart.
Those are some of your people over there.
No, not really. I never plunge the depths of crap wagon, even at
the
darkest
days. I love going
to
crap wagon. It always makes me feel better about myself. I haven't totally lost my mind. It is a guilty pleasure. I've
yes, you've long admitted that, and I've never understood it. Are there any other topics about Detroit that we should address before we cover a little preview of Texas? We're running a little bit long here, so I don't want to spend too much of people's time. But did we miss anything glaring?
The only thing I would say is great weekend by James Jakes as well. Talking about putting on a great career weekend. James, that second race really wearing, they finished second, I think. And Dale Coyne racing for the weekend. Wow, what a great weekend they had.
Yeah.
They had the Justin Wilson.
Probably the height of their performance in Dale's IndyCar career right now.
Yeah, you got to think they're running pretty high. They had a fifth place finish with Justin at Indianapolis. They had the podium in the third on Saturday, and Conway was third again on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
They come into Texas this weekend where they're the defending champions.
That's right. So that's a good segue into doing a little preview of Texas. So here's an interesting little tidbit. As you mentioned, Justin Wilson being the defending champion of Texas. Guess who's driving for Dale Coyne Racing this weekend?
They're our friend Pippa Mann.
It would be her. So here's my take on it. I think that, well, really, in a way, Pippa can't lose, because if things don't go well, then people will just say, oh, it's just Dale Coyne. They just don't have their act together. But if they do go well, then they'll say, oh, wow, she had a great team. And look, there is her opportunity to show her talent. And so it's kind of a really good situation for her. But I do think that this weekend needs to be considered pivotal for her as an opportunity to show what she can do and to silence her doubters if it is going to happen, because Cyclops Gear apparently is very happy with her. And I think that this is her opportunity to get some momentum going in her favor if the weekend goes well.
I would agree. You know, there aren't a whole lot of other ovals coming up beyond this that I think Pippa's going to, you know, likely be able to jump into. So maybe something at Fontana at the end of the year. But I think I agree. This is her chance to really shine and show what she can do.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully, I think the best thing for Pippa is if we really don't hear much from her over the weekend.
Yeah, I think that's very, very apt. So here's another addition for this weekend, and a lot of us knew that this was coming. Oriel Servia being in the number 4 for Panther Racing, of course, not being in the number 22 post-Indy because of the closure of Dreyer and Reinbold Racing. Apparently was not able to get the strings untied from the contract in time to be in the car for Detroit. But the interesting thing about this announcement is that they said that it was for Texas and Iowa. And in between Texas and Iowa is a little race in Milwaukee, and I don't believe it was included in the announcement. And I don't believe that Briscoe is available to race in Milwaukee because there's this little race happening in France in a couple weeks that I think he needs to be in Europe to prepare for. So
wouldn't you rather go run in Milwaukee than the 24 Le Mans?
No.
All right, I'll give you.
Sorry.
All right. Well, then let's play who gets the car at Milwaukee. Who do you have left?
No, I'm not good at this game. I'm not good at this game.
I don't know. There'll be some, you know, maybe you look at a Townsend Bell. I think he could be a strong shoe there.
Doesn't Buddy Rice get in that car a lot?
Buddy Rice was the next name I was going to say.
So that's a possibility, I guess. But it's becoming a little bit of a revolving door. In the number 4 for the rest of the year, it looks like. So would love to know why that decision was made, but it's none of our business. So
it is none of your business.
All right. Who you got to win this weekend, Paul?
Boy, this is getting harder and harder all the time.
More like idiots every time we try.
Uh-huh. And now that it really looks like Honda's come back a little bit, they had a strong weekend last year. Same thing they did last year when one of the Ganassi guys led a lot here. Was it Franchitti that led and then crashed? It was either Franchitti or Dick.
Familiar.
Yeah, one of them crashed leading at Texas. The other one crashed the next week at Milwaukee, and I can't remember which was which.
No, I think Dario was at Milwaukee. Anyway, it's immaterial.
Yes. Boy, who do I got to win? I still think Chevy's going to pull it out. I still think I think Andretti is still on top of their oval game. I am going to take Ryan Hunter-Reay.
You know, I came into this thinking that I was going to pick Marco, but as I'm sitting here thinking about it while I have to formulate the words and spit them out, Marco's never really had 1.5 milers have never really been his strength. And for some reason, I've just got this bug in my ear that I think Takuma Sato might come up with something this weekend. So I'm going to go with Taku.
Oh, all right.
Maybe another repeat winner for this year.
Huh. AJ Foyt actually gets to go to victory lane legitimately at Texas this time, huh?
Maybe.
Hopefully he won't just smack somebody in the head this time.
I'm sure he would be very happy, and the fans would be too, to see him in there. So that would be a nice feel-good story to go along with a good win if that were to happen. So just a couple of quick things that we want to mention to you before we sign off. We have one of our new contributors, John Lingle, who you've heard a couple of times on the podcast this year. He will be in Texas all weekend long, so make sure that you follow him on Twitter at JDLingle, LINGLE. Keep an eye on the website, morefrontwing.com, as well. You'll be getting daily updates from him. And if you should happen to need any statistics or schedules or weather forecasts or anything like that at any point during the weekend, you can find it all at our now very easy to access page. Our latest event summary is always, as Paul mentioned earlier, at morefrontwing.com/event summary. And right now, when you pull that up, you'll see the 2013 Texas Firestone 550 at Texas Motor Speedway, and we're looking forward to it. So I think that's everything, and we're ready to call it a day. Thanks very much, Paul, and thanks as well to John Oriovitz, who joined us earlier, the contributor to ESPN.com. Always great to have him on. And with that, we will send you off to Texas Motor Speedway. But if you, in the meantime, should happen to need any IndyCar news and views, get a grip with more Front Wing.